As is now well known, about 6 seconds after the deal was signed, the North Koreans began feverishly building nuclear bombs. In October 2002, the regime admitted it had a nuclear weapons program, and in fact had been working on it at least since the mid or late 1990s, according to the New York Times. But right up until the Bush administration caught the North Koreans red-handed, the experts were assuring us that the 1994 peace deal had been a smashing success. This was the deal liberals were claiming Bush's axis of evil speech had thrown off track. After Bush called the Pyongyang regime evil, Clinton complained that Bush was wrecking the great strides his administration had made with North Korea. "I figured I left the next administration with a big foreign policy win." Madeleine Albright, who had daintily proposed that terrorist nations such as North Korea not be called rogue nations, but rather states of concern, was duly mortified by Bush's axis of evil speech. The principal area of disagreement among the ponderers was why Bush had called North Korea part of the axis of evil in the first place. Liberals were simply stumped. New York Times reporter Elizabeth Buemiller said that what Bush meant by calling Iran, Iraq, and North Korea evil has been left open to guessing. "I think I know what he meant. I believe he meant that the three nations were evil." The experts discounted that explanation out of hand. NBC News military analyst Bill Arkin claimed that Bush had thrown North Korea into the mix as window dressing for Muslim countries. Bush did not want to stigmatize the Middle East, he said. David Albright of the Institute for Science and International Security made the fascinating argument that Bush had called North Korea part of an axis of evil based in part on a hatred of the Clinton administration policy across the board. Clinton National Security staffer Antony Blinken said Bush's axis of evil phrase was a gambit to distract the public's attention from things less comfortable, like the economy and the Enron scandal. After all the experts had spent months bashing Bush for jeopardizing the brilliant 1994 deal, North Korea admitted it had ignored the deal from the beginning. Months after North Korea admitted to a nuclear program, U.S. intelligence forces tracked an unmarked ship carrying Scud missiles from North Korea to Yemen, this despite the fact that they were different countries. The North Koreans were not only making missiles, but trafficking in them. North Korea was beginning to look a lot like a third member of an axis of evil. Instead of owning up to their now ludicrous attacks on Bush and unbridled praise for Clinton's peace agreement, the ponderers once again concluded that Bush was a moron. Apparently, Bush had somehow driven the North Koreans to violate the agreement by being mean to them. North Korea was a beacon of peace until Bush called it evil, forcing Kim Jong-il to build nuclear weapons, leaving unexplained why Pyongyang started developing nuclear weapons while Clinton was still president. Robert Einhorn, who helped negotiate the 1994 peace deal, said Bush's tough rhetoric and tough policies must have unnerved the North Koreans, forcing them into rapidly acquiring a substantial nuclear arsenal. Clintonites blaming the Bush administration for the North Koreans' breach of the 1994 deal was nothing if not audacious. They could barely restrain their glee that one of their boys in the third world had checkmated Bush. America was in a pickle now. Good for Kim Jong-il. In an article titled "Outfoxed by North Korea," Leon Firth, Al Gore's national security advisor, and naturally a professor, crowed, "It is certain that the Bush administration now faces an immediate loss of credibility." To review the record, the only people in the universe who had been outfoxed by the North Koreans were liberals. Just 2 months into his presidency, Bush canceled ongoing peace talks with North Korea, stating matter-of-factly that Pyongyang would cheat on any agreement that was not verifiable. But according to Firth, the North Koreans had hoodwinked Bush. They had put him in the awkward position of choosing to give war with Iraq priority over North Korea. Here was the nub of the matter. North Korea had given liberals another excuse to oppose invading Iraq. Months earlier, they had hooted with laughter when Bush called North Korea evil. But as the nation prepared to invade Iraq, liberals were suddenly overwhelmed by the evil that was North Korea. This was a country that was so evil, Iraq would have to wait. Inasmuch as liberals also wanted to wait for the second ice age to invade Iraq, their arguments for giving North Korea top billing lacked something in the way of credibility. While pretending to believe the North Koreans had quickly assembled a massive Manhattan Project and developed a nuclear bomb in 9 months flat, liberals insisted there was no need to worry about Saddam Hussein because he was not an imminent threat. Of course, they had also once assured us that North Korea was not an imminent threat. Joel Witt, who helped negotiate the celebrated peace agreement, said, "If we attacked Iraq next year as opposed to next month, I'm not sure the situation would be that different. The North Koreans, on the other hand, seem to be moving gung-ho toward making nuclear weapons." Yes, that makes it a little trickier, doesn't it? Weeks before the Iraq invasion, Senator Teddy Kennedy was bloviating about North Korea on television, saying our principal focus and attention today ought to be what is happening in North Korea. North Korea has produced nuclear weapons. It has a missile that can reach the United States. We ought to be talking to a North Korea that has nuclear weapons rather than going to war with Iraq that does not. Democrats who had voted for the resolution of force against Iraq leapt on the failure of Clinton's 1994 peace deal to repudiate their votes. Senator Charles Schumer, who had voted in favor of the Iraq resolution, said, "You don't have to be a PhD in foreign relations to understand that North Korea poses a greater danger to the United States than Iraq." Apparently, we didn't need to check with the Allies to make that call. Liberals were utterly hysterical with their contradictory arguments. It was so obvious that North Korea was trouble precisely because it might already have nukes, making the case for invading Iraq and dismantling their nuclear program even stronger. But try to explain that to a liberal. The New York Times said North Korea had blown apart the Bush administration's months-long effort to portray Saddam Hussein as uniquely dangerous, gleefully brandishing Clinton's failed North Korea policy as an argument for inaction on Iraq. The Times announced that Washington could not afford the luxury of deferring the North Korea problem until it has finished disarming Iraq. North Korea was only the latest ploy in liberals' national security shell game. As America contemplated action against Iraq, liberals kept tossing out other problems they insisted would have to be addressed first. This is supposed to prevent anyone from accusing them of being worthless appeasers. The left is all for aggressive military action, but never against any country America is about to attack. In opposing war with Iraq, liberals variously cited Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Arafat, Pakistan, Syria, Osama bin Laden, and North Korea as more pressing problems than Iraq. Bush should have called their bluff and attacked all 40 countries liberals claimed to be itching to attack before Iraq. Despite liberals' dazzling point earlier in the year that Iraq, Iran, and North Korea were very different countries, surprisingly enough, their approach to all three was the same. Whether dealing with an evil regime that might already have nuclear weapons, North Korea, or an evil empire still trying to develop nuclear weapons, Iraq, the crucial thing, as liberals saw it, was to do nothing. Or at least to do nothing that would annoy the despots. Or if not nothing, then maybe give dangerous despots nuclear reactors and billions of dollars in aid to make them like us. While claiming we couldn't attack Iraq because we had to deal with North Korea, the Times also said we couldn't attack North Korea. Military action would risk a violent North Korean response. So who could we attack? And why should we listen to the New York Times? In a single editorial, the Times urged multilateral diplomacy, a firm diplomatic response, and diplomatic solutions. It would be much better to wait for North Korea to develop lots of nuclear weapons and unify with South Korea before we tried anything too bellicose. Derek Mitchell, who worked in the Clinton administration, proposed that the U.S. not isolate the North Koreans, engage in more missile talks, and perhaps find out what Kim Jong-il's favorite chocolates were. The North Koreans were insecure. Liberals' bold plan for action was to be nice to them. Defying the uniform demands of the nation's op-ed pages, the Bush administration opted against spoon-feeding prepared meals to 2 million North Korean troops. To the contrary, Bush said he would not negotiate until the Pyongyang regime dismantled its nuclear weapons program and threatened the North Koreans with total economic collapse. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said any assumption that the U.S. would not use force against North Korea would be a mistake. Such bellicosity frightens liberals. The left's reaction to nutty despots is, "He might hit me, so I'll be nice." Rumsfeld's idea is, "He'll hit me, maybe I'll hit him." The beauty of that approach cannot be denied. Liberals look at life from the perspective of people who feel defenseless. They shrink from bullies, have a phobia about hitting, and warn children not to play with firecrackers or they'll lose an eye. Jimmy Carter claimed to have been attacked by a giant swimming rabbit. That's really all you need to know about the Democrats. Instead of relentlessly attacking the military as immature or testosterone-crazed, meaning braver than me, liberals might have the good grace to realize they live in a country where big burly men are willing to protect them from bullies. As far as I'm aware, the military does not interfere in the fashion industry. They don't have a lot of opinions about Broadway plays or write poetry like Clinton's Secretary of Defense William Cohen. Why can't liberals let men defend the country? Chapter 13, Celebrity Traders. Now that I'm sober, I watch a lot of news. No account of the war on terrorism would be complete without mentioning the underwear models. As America embarked on the greatest battle for its survival since the end of the Cold War, the nation cried out for the opinions of the most frivolous people in the universe, celebrities. Singers, models, actors, writers, and vegan hysteric Kim Basinger all came out against the war. Liberals see themselves as part of a deployment, and Hollywood celebrities were their generals. With Vietnam, it took a while for the anti-war movement to get going. Now we have an instant sedition lobby. The attack of 9/11 was understandably disturbing to celebrities. It created an unpleasant sensation that there was something in the world more important than them and their sybaritic doings in New York nightclubs. In general, wildly overpaid narcissists are the last people who should be commenting on subjects of any importance. But the Hollywood left insisted on airing their infantile Oedipal disorders in public. Actor Woody Harrelson wrote an article in the London Guardian saying, "I'm an American tired of lies, and with our government it's mostly lies." He informed the foreign audience that America intended to wipe out random, non-white nations. Harrelson even assailed the United States food drop military campaign in Afghanistan as an unprovoked act of aggression. The warmongers of the Bush administration stole the White House and were waging a perpetual war on any non-white country they choose to describe as terrorist. Actress Jessica Lange denounced the impending war with Iraq as unconstitutional, immoral, and illegal. She said the Iraq plan was absolutely mad, thus outsmarting Barbara Streisand by getting the name of the country right. With only slightly less subtlety than the New York Times editorial page, she added, "I hate Bush. I despise him and his entire administration." Actress Susan Sarandon said, "Nobody is answering any of the big questions. Where's the big thing? You know, I know there's going to be thousands of people injured, killed. This is something that needs rigorous debate. Nobody has said, it's not a Nintendo game. This is something that, you know, where's the plan once we get in? How many people do we commit to that area? How do we get in there? What happened afterwards? Nobody is discussing this, and I believe that if some of these details were discussed, these statistics that they're giving us about blind following would crash, because if you ask somebody, are you willing to send your son, the whole story changes." In March 2003, not long before the war began, Iraqi soldiers heard shooting and, thinking the war had started, crossed the border into Kuwait and tried to surrender to British troops. The British had to send them back. The peace lobby wanted to keep these people in Saddam's prison. After Barbara Streisand ignominiously relinquished her leadership position in the anti-war movement when Matt Drudge pointed out she didn't know which country we were invading, Janine Garofalo became the mascot of the Activism R Us Hollywood Coalition. She explained her newfound activism, saying, "Now that I'm sober, I watch a lot of news." When a feminist as strident as Garofalo was defending the Hussein regime, you had to wonder if her newfound sobriety had hit a rough patch. Garofalo said, "Dropping bombs on the Iraqis is not going to disarm Saddam." "No, it will kill him. That's good enough." Trading in her Gen X sneer for a nitwit's hysteria, Garofalo warned, "America will pay a very, very high, irrevocable price for this. The Lemon Puckerpuss said extremist groups will strike us if we do this war. Things were going just great for us before. That's if you don't count the unpleasantness of September 11th, the attacks on the USS Cole, the attacks on our Air Force housing complex in Saudi Arabia, Pan Am Flight 103, our Marine barracks in Beirut, and our embassies in Kenya, Tanzania, Lebanon, and Iran." Garofalo demanded to know why she wasn't being taken seriously in her opposition to war with Iraq, while asserting, "There is no evidence of weapons of mass destruction." The Kurds and Iranians would be surprised to hear that, inasmuch as Saddam Hussein had already used his weapons of mass destruction on them. It's a mystery why people don't take Janine seriously. 3 days after the September 11th attacks, Madonna was on stage in Los Angeles, exhorting the audience to pray for no retaliation against the perpetrators. Between songs and simulated live sex acts, the always circumspect gay disco chanteuse explained, "Violence begets violence. In February 2003, Madonna put the world on notice. Her latest music video contained a shocking anti-war message, featuring footage of Iraqi children and mushroom clouds. It was expected to be a bigger draw than her latest movie, featuring Madonna in a bathing suit. Madonna's ex-husband, Sean Penn, was not to be outvogued. Penn took out a $56,000 ad in the Washington Post addressed to President Bush, saying, "I beg you, help save America before yours is a legacy of shame and horror." In December 2002, Penn went to Iraq to record the human face of the Iraqi people so that their blood, along with that of American soldiers, would not be invisible on my own hands. He reminded the New York Times that his family had been ravaged by McCarthyism, reflecting on the bitter experience in the 1950s of his father, the film director and television producer Leo Penn, who was blacklisted by Hollywood studios for 5 years after refusing to testify during the communist scare of the McCarthy years. As millions of people were sentenced to gulags and death in Stalin's Russia, Leo Penn was forced to fire the maid. It was heart-wrenching. As war with Iraq drew closer, George Clooney gave Charlie Rose the inside tip that Bush had cut a deal with France so they wouldn't complain when we attacked Iraq. Apparently, even the French have more manhood than George Clooney. They never did stop complaining. Dustin Hoffman said that Bush has taken the events of 9/11 and has manipulated the grief of the country, and I think that's reprehensible. He explained that this war is about what most wars are about: hegemony, money, power, and oil. It's not just that, as Roy Cohn pointed out, actors' only provable skill is in imitating other people. A high IQ is generally an impediment to being a good actor. Even model Kate Moss took time out from her drug habit to really wrap her head around the war issue. Terrified that an attack on Iraq could lead to an attack on Colombia and dry up her supply, she was foursquare against the war. Judging by the gossip pages, her pacifism apparently does not extend to hotel furniture. Michael Moore, director of phony documentaries, which he passes off as real, sympathized with the terrorist goals but complained that they had killed the wrong Americans. In the terrorist defense, Moore said, "We have orphaned so many children, tens of thousands around the world, with our taxpayer-funded terrorism." To follow the train of tortured logic that requires introspection about how America brought the attack of 9/11 on itself is to dance on the graves of those 3,000 Americans. This is liberalism gone totally haywire. A year later, Moore was laughing at the people on the planes hijacked on 9/11, saying they were cowards for not fighting back. Apparently, Moore believed it was only appropriate to fight dagger-wielding savages when battling them in hand-to-hand combat, but not with high-tech precision weaponry developed by stupid white men. He opposed war with Afghanistan, and then he opposed war with Iraq. 2 days after the attack, novelist Norman Mailer, whose last successful novel was written 54 years ago, said the crumpled World Trade Center was more beautiful than the building was. He said America was the most hated nation on Earth. Like Moore, Mailer believed the victims of the terrorist attack were simply the wrong targets. You've got that many people killed who've had nothing to do with bringing on their own death other than working in a monument to corporatism. As he saw it, the terrorist attack was retaliation for the Happy Meal. We come in and we insist on establishing enclaves of our food there, like McDonald's. Giving an interview from his home in Cape Cod, the multimillionaire author said people of other nations enjoy being poor. He pompously criticized Americans for refusing to recognize that large parts of the world, particularly the most backward nations, see us as cultural oppressors and aesthetic oppressors. Until America faced up to the reality that the huge profit-making way of life is not necessarily a good fit for most countries, he said, we are going to be in trouble. Liberals adore ludicrous third-world dictators who torture people. Attacking wealth from their beachfront estates makes liberals sound like bon vivants on the society pages. Angry that Bush intended to invade Iraq rather than send troops to surround McDonald's headquarters, Mailer sniffed that Iraq was not a danger. He said, it doesn't matter what they're up to in Iraq. It doesn't matter if they have nuclear bombs or not, or whether they're ready to do chemical warfare. Again, the Kurds might disagree. The only reason we were going to war with Iraq, he said, was to build an empire, and Iraq was absolutely a position in the world we need militarily. It would start with Iraq, then move to the Near East, and then Bush would make China the Greece to our Rome. Alice Walker wrote in the Village Voice that America should shower Osama bin Laden with love. What would happen to his cool armor if he could be reminded of all the good, nonviolent things he has done? Maybe Walker could remind us of what those things are, too. Senator Patty Murray, who was not a celebrity except for the IQ, told a group of schoolchildren that America needed to understand why Osama bin Laden was so popular and concluded that Osama was beloved because, I quote, "He's been out in these countries for decades, building schools, building roads, building infrastructure, building daycare facilities, building healthcare facilities, and people are extremely grateful. He's made their lives better. We have not done that." Yes, bin Laden was building daycare facilities for all the working women struggling with career and family under the Taliban. It was like an April Fool's Day hoax. Murray simply assumed the whole NOW agenda was on Osama's program. Self-esteem, infrastructure, battered women's shelters, aromatherapy, the whole nine yards. There's something about murderous dictators who hate the United States that celebrities find irresistible. They think it makes them seem wild and randy to hobnob with mass murderers. Totalitarians make good theater. Harry Belafonte, a self-described victim of McCarthyism, was one of the few to live long enough to transition seamlessly from praising Bolshevik heathen to defending Islamic terrorists. As celebrities raged with anti-American fervor in the war on terrorism, a writer for The Nation magazine raised the specter of McCarthyism, saying back in the 1950s, an awful lot of lives were damaged by sloppy allegations of disloyalty. He doesn't mention whether or not the allegations were true. That's not the point. Celebrities feel the lash of censorship at the mere hint of criticism. Implying there was brutal suppression of dissent in America, Woody Harrelson said, "God forbid you should suggest the war is unjust." Jessica Lange said she found the atmosphere in America poisonous, intolerable for those of us who are not right-wing. Susan Sarandon complained, "I'm tired of being labeled anti-American because I ask questions." Actors seem to think they have a constitutional right to say stupid things and have no one criticize them. Public reproach is the equivalent of being thrown in a gulag. Sissy actors so longed for pretend persecution, they would have attributed bad weather to a right-wing McCarthyite blacklist. In a modern version of the Iran-Iraq War, actor Sean Penn accused Steve Bing, Hollywood producer and general degenerate, of blacklisting him from a film in retaliation for his peacenik activities. Bing had not only donated millions of dollars to the Democratic Party, but actively supports the Democrat lifestyle by fathering illegitimate children. While objecting to having their patriotism questioned as they attacked America, celebrities made a big point of claiming to be the superior patriots for their constant kvetching. They never change, these liberals. Consider the behavior of America's premier Lord Ha-Ha, former President Jimmy Carter. Just hours after the United States Congress authorized the use of force against Iraq, Norway, the country that gave us the term Quisling, voted to give Carter the Nobel Peace Prize, warmly citing Carter's opposition to the war. The moment the Quislings voted to give Carter his award, in honor of his vocal opposition to the war policies of his own country, the press sprang to action, calling our Lord Ha-Ha America's greatest ex-president. Carter would travel to Norway to accept the award in December 2002, 2 months after Congress had authorized war against Iraq. In his acceptance speech, he warned against powerful countries adopting a principle of preventive war. He babbled about the importance of peace, harmony, international consensus, and the preeminent importance of the United Nations. Fortunately for Hollywood liberals and former Democratic presidents, the country discontinued prosecuting treason long ago. When the country decided not to prosecute Jane Fonda after the Vietnam War, the bar was raised. World War II-era traitors were prosecuted and sentenced to long prison terms for radio broadcasts heard by no one within America. Axa Sally was an American actress by the name of Mildred Gillers, who tried to demoralize American troops from Berlin by chipperly informing them that their wives and girlfriends were cheating on them. Tokyo Rose, and there were actually several of them, took a more ham-handed approach, but also used feminine wiles to try to demoralize American GIs. Axa Sally was sentenced to 12 years in prison. Tokyo Rose got 6 years in prison. Hanoi Jane makes aerobics videos. During the Vietnam War, Fonda gave wild, inflammatory anti-American speeches from Hanoi. She mugged four photographers while posing with North Vietnamese anti-aircraft guns. At the time, serious thought was given to prosecuting her, but the ruling class was equivocal about treason. Fonda's case is emblematic of what liberals think is demanded of them as Americans. Penn wasn't even worried he would be unpopular, much less charged with treason. In the war on terrorism, the most Americans could hope for was that no Hollywood actress would have an affair with Saddam Hussein. America is such a wealthy country, now even treason is cheap. Chapter 14, Modern McCarthyism. This is what it meant in the 50s, too. Bitterly disheartened by the outburst of patriotism across the nation after 9/11, liberals quickly channeled their frustration into claiming that President Bush had advanced knowledge of the terrorist attack. Republicans were so dumbstruck by the Democrats' mendacity, they overlooked the most stunning legerdemain of the accusation. Suppose Bush had known 19 Muslim immigrants planned to hijack 4 planes on a certain day. What could he have done? Throw Arabs out of the country? Put them in preventative detention? Order airport security to take an extra little peek at swarthy men boarding planes? Liberals wouldn't let us do that after 9/11. Instead of demanding to know what Bush knew before September 11th, the more urgent question was, what did the Democrats know after September 11th? The left's principal contribution to stopping another terrorist attack was to go into high dudgeon every time anyone in the Bush administration talked to a Muslim. They wailed about McCarthyism and claimed to be very, very concerned, not about terrorist attacks on America, but about civil liberties. Liberals' idea for fighting domestic terrorism was to hold folk song rallies with Muslims. In May 2002, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, said that it was imperative that Bush tell the Senate what actions were taken in response to any advance warning of a terrorist attack. Leahy hauled Attorney General John Ashcroft before the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying he was very angry at Ashcroft. Not because Ashcroft was failing to do enough to prevent the next terrorist attack. Just the opposite. He was doing too much, thereby threatening the civil liberties of Arabs. In a girly girl, eye-poking attack, House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt demanded an investigation into what the White House knew about the events leading up to the attack, when they knew it, and most importantly, what was done about it. Gephardt's genius plan for assuring air safety after September 11th was to federalize airport security. But he refused to allow airport security to scrutinize passengers who look like the last 24 terrorists who attacked civilian aircraft. That's what he did when he knew about it. Democrats claimed to be indignant that nothing was done in response to the memo from an FBI agent in Phoenix who had noticed a lot of Arabs enrolled in American flight schools. But as the New York Times reported, FBI officials said there was reluctance at the time to mount such a major review because of a concern that the Bureau would be criticized for ethnic profiling of foreigners. Let's see, who might have criticized the FBI for ethnic profiling? For Ashcroft's evident interest in immigrants of Middle Eastern descent rather than white male currency traders after September 11th, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee railed that the detention of Arabs smacks of racial profiling. Representative Maxine Waters said the Bush administration was literally dismantling justice. Senator Hillary Clinton, whose very first act in the Senate was to sponsor a bill prohibiting ethnic profiling, also demanded an investigation into what Bush knew and when he knew it. What did she know about her husband's nightly philandering, and when did she know it? In the midst of their constant carping, liberals refused to attack Bush for the one real black mark on the administration's anti-terrorism efforts, Norman Mineta. Bursting with bipartisan bon ami after he was elected, Bush made Democrat Mineta his Secretary of Transportation. At the time, transportation was a relatively unimportant department. It would be difficult even for a Democrat to screw it up. After 19 Arabs turned passenger airplanes into cruise missiles, the Transportation Department was no longer a trivial position, and Bush had a Clinton holdover in the job. If the government had hired expensive Harvard-trained consultants to try to figure out a way to make the flying experience even more unpleasant after September 11th, the consultants would have thrown their hands up in despair. But chalk one up to the Democrats. One lone bureaucrat at the Department of Transportation did it on his own. In classic Democrat fashion, Mineta piled on lots of useless regulations that would inconvenience the maximum number of airline passengers, while, at the same time, making the planes no safer. The most important thing, as Mineta saw it, was to prohibit airport screeners from paying any extra attention to anyone who looked like the last several dozen terrorists to attack American aircraft, embassies, and military installations. Instead, he insisted that airlines go through the manifestly absurd exercise of strip-searching little old ladies. Here, finally, was something the Bush administration should have been raked over the coals for, but the Democratic Party was the dog that didn't bark. If law enforcement officers ever dared paw through the belongings of an Egyptian immigrant named Mustafa with the fascist intensity of airport security patting down little old ladies suspected of flying to Iowa, liberals would have exploded in righteous indignation. But they didn't make a peep. In early December 2001, 60 Minutes host Steve Croft interviewed Mineta about his approach to securing the airlines from terrorist attack. Croft observed that of the 22 men currently on the FBI's most wanted list, all but one of them has a complexion listed as olive. They all have dark hair and brown eyes. And more than half of them have the name Muhammad. Thus, he asked Mineta if airport security should give more scrutiny to someone named Muhammad. Just going down a manifest list. Bob, Paul, John, Frank, Stephen, Muhammad. The Secretary of Transportation said no. In fact, Mineta was mystified, asking Croft, why should Muhammad be singled out? The Federal Aviation Administration had a computer profiling system on passengers, but it actually excluded mention of passengers' race, ethnicity, national origin, or religion. What do they have? Mineta explained that airport security was able to consider other, more important factors than race, including asking things like, did you pay cash for this ticket or charge it on a credit card? Do you have a one-way ticket or a round trip? Croft asked the relevant follow-up question. Did the terrorists who flew into the World Trade Center have one-way tickets? No, Mineta said. The terrorist hijackers all had round-trip tickets bought with credit cards. So the factors airport security was allowed to consider would not have stopped the 9/11 attack, and the factors that could have prevented the 9/11 attack were required to be ignored. Mineta obstinately refused to consider a relevant airport screening procedure on the grounds that 50 years earlier, another Democrat had put him in an internment camp. I remember on the 29th of May, 1942. Note that he remembers the day. When we boarded the train in San Jose under armed guard, the military guard, I was in my Cub Scout uniform carrying a baseball glove, and baseball bat. And as I boarded the train, the MPs confiscated the bat on the basis it could be used as a lethal weapon. A guard took Mineta's baseball bat as a child, and as a result, he was subjecting all of America to the Bataan Death March. There was no principled basis for opposition to using Arab appearance as a factor in airport security screening procedures. The whole country knew that goosing little old ladies boarding planes was not making us any safer. It was so patently absurd that even the New York Times let a surprisingly sensible opinion piece through the politically correct gauntlet titled, Let Them Profile Me. The writer described security hassles she had encountered in airports all over the world on account of her Lebanese birth, name, and looks. But then she pointed out that Arab Americans don't want to die either. Does anyone really want a security official to hesitate before stopping a suspicious passenger out of fear of an accusation of bias? Yes, in fact. There were precisely two groups of people who desperately wanted airport security to be browbeaten out of giving suspicious passengers an extra look. Terrorists and Democrats. Even the Supreme Court was never this crazy. To the contrary, in a 1975 case called United States versus Brignone Ponce, the court held that the Mexican appearance of a car's occupants could be considered by border police stopping cars near the Mexican border to look for illegal aliens. American lives were put at risk in the name of political correctness. Safe on Air Force One, Bush did nothing to stop this menace at the Transportation Department, and the Democrats didn't complain. The moment Mineta mentioned the Japanese internment, a Democrat idea, they were paralyzed. The Democrats had one clear shot at the Bush administration, but they wouldn't take it. This is what the Democrats did when they knew about it. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman sniffed that racial profiling was not civilized. He blamed 20 years of relentless attacks by Muslim extremists on, I quote, religious fundamentalists of any stripe. I don't know, Amish extremists have been rather quiet recently. If all this carnage and murder had been committed by anti-abortion extremists rather than Muslim extremists, it's unlikely that Friedman would be pussyfooting around the issue by referring to the culprits as political extremists of any stripe. He ruefully concluded that our only choices were to become less open as a society or simply to live with much higher levels of risk. I have another solution. It's a little something I like to call racial profiling. My logic is this. In 20 years of relentless attacks on America by Muslim extremists, there is a common thread. In every one of these attacks by Muslim extremists, there appears to be one or more Muslim extremists involved. This ought to help the airlines and law enforcement engage in more accurate risk assessment. To review the evidence, on September 11, 2001, over 3,000 Americans were murdered in a savage attack on U.S. soil by Muslim extremists. On October 2000, our warship, the USS Cole, was attacked by Muslim extremists. In 1998, U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1996, a U.S. Air Force housing complex in Saudi Arabia was bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1995, 5 Americans were killed by a car bomb set by Muslim extremists. In 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1988, another passenger jet, Pan Am Flight 103, was bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1986, a West Berlin discotheque frequented by U.S. servicemen was bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1985, an Italian cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, was seized and a 69-year-old American was killed by Muslim extremists. In 1983, the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut were blown up by Muslim extremists. In 1982, the U.S. Embassy in Beirut was bombed by Muslim extremists. In 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Iran was stormed and American embassy staff held hostage for 444 days by Muslim extremists. So naturally, Democrats refused to allow law enforcement to look for Muslim extremists. While braying about what Bush knew and when he knew it, liberals had nothing but contempt for Attorney General John Ashcroft, the man in the Bush administration doing the most to ensure another act of domestic terrorism did not occur. Annoyed that they did not have enough grist for the anti-war mill, Democrats began complaining about every reasonable national security measure at home. Liberals were angrier at John Ashcroft for questioning Arab visitors to this country than they were about the terrorists. Newsweek's Eleanor Clift ridiculed Ashcroft for his pomposity. She complained incomprehensibly about the terrorism alerts. Why did Ashcroft insist on issuing the alerts? Perhaps to warn of terrorist threats? She complained that not enough lawyers were rushing to court to undermine the government's monitoring of terrorist jailhouse conversations. These alleged civil liberties concerns had only one purpose: to give Muslims a cushion for another attack on America. Unable to root for al-Qaeda openly, Democrats lodged surly objections to the Bureau of Prisons for listening to the conversations of prison inmates suspected of plotting terrorist attacks. Senator Leahy complained about Ashcroft's disappointing failure to run all internal guideline changes past the Senate Judiciary Committee. On the basis of how Senator Leahy was reviewing Bush's judicial nominees, if he were also required to review Justice Department guidelines, America would be an Islamic regime before he got around to holding a vote. In June 2002, the New York Times editorial page was in a snit with the Supreme Court for its first ruling on the Bush administration's wartime security procedures. Despite the clearly stated position of the Times editorial board, the Supreme Court had ruled for Ashcroft. Deportation hearings of suspected terrorists would not be open to the public. This, the Times said, was troubling. Sadly, the Constitution does not require that national security be compromised. Representative Jose Serrano, Democrat of New York, said Ashcroft's detention of 2 al-Qaeda terrorists as enemy combatants was frightening. A few months after 9/11, 40 congressmen released a letter lambasting Bush for his plan to use military tribunals for enemy combatants. Signing the letter were 39 Democrats, one Vermont independent, and one lone Republican, who was soon voted out of office. A major political party that won a plurality of the popular vote in the last presidential election wanted to treat terrorists like Martha Stewart facing an insider trading charge. human rights groups responded to the detention of every suspected terrorist with paranoid accusations of police state tactics. Liberals seemed to imagine that the FBI had nothing better to do than to sit around investigating how much time they were spending logged on to panties.com. Compared to any similar circumstance in U.S. history, Ashcroft was remarkably restrained. In 1924, after the homes of 8 government officials were bombed, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, appointed by Democrat Woodrow Wilson, though still serving under President Calvin Coolidge, rounded up 6,000 people. In 1942, after a sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, committed by a country, not resident aliens, a Democrat president put more than 100,000 Japanese residents and citizens in internment camps. By contrast, in the months following the most devastating terrorist attack in world history, in which 3,000 Americans were killed, John Ashcroft detained just over 700 non-citizens, many on immigration violations. 18 months later, more than 100 of them had been convicted or pleaded guilty to terrorism-related offenses, and another 489 had been deported or left the United States willingly. Even Time magazine had to admit that, despite the wails of civil liberties groups, it is clear at least some of the detainees are exactly the sort of people Americans would want the FBI to zero in on. But the Progressive magazine vowed that Ashcroft's detention of a relatively small number of law-breaking aliens will go down in history as the Ashcroft raids. With very little disruption and surprisingly few arrests, Ashcroft prevented another act of terrorism for well over a year after the 9/11 attack. Preventing terrorism doesn't receive as much news coverage as the alternative. But from 9/11 through the end of 2002, the Bush administration had thwarted an estimated 100 or more attacks against the United States and its interests. That stunning fact appeared in the middle of a small news item on page A11 of the New York Times. Few other news outlets mentioned it at all. It's safe to assume Ashcroft wasn't getting a lot of help, and yet he calmly persisted in the face of caterwauling idiots. This is a country virtually designed for terrorist attacks. America is a big multicultural society full of densely packed cities with large foreign-born populations and hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants. Try this with another country. Hello, Indian Embassy? I would like to immigrate to your country. I have no money, no ambition, and no prospects, but I hear you have a generous welfare program and I want to start a big family and bring my extended family with me, all of whom consider your nation the Great Satan. Foreigners were relentlessly staging raids on our border, which was defended by a hapless bunch of incompetents at the Immigration and Naturalization Service. But the only complaints about the INS came from conservatives. Liberals view their own non-compliance with immigration laws as a sort of friendly neighbor program. They think America is a department store, and no one can be denied entry. The nation's political ethos demands that we pretend we don't suspect Egyptian immigrant Hesham Mohammed Hidayat any more than Al Gore. The rights of the accused trump the rights of the law-abiding. Special interest groups defend the right of predators to move freely in the general population. There are bands of lawyers ready to sue in response to any incident of law enforcement, just like back in Syria. The FBI was surely more polite to Middle Eastern immigrants than people in their home countries would be to us under similar circumstances. Sensing that screaming about the civil liberties of terrorists was not impressing normal Americans, Democrats switched gears and began assailing Bush for not doing enough about domestic security. Senator John Edwards said, "It's time for us, without regard to party, to say what every American knows. Washington is not doing enough to make America safe." Senator John Kerry said the Bush administration had failed to make the preparations necessary to properly deal with an obvious problem of growing terror and the threat at home. Senator Joseph Lieberman said this administration has been slow and inadequate in response to the terrorist threat here at home. The fact that the Democrats were rushing to have their warnings duly placed on the record was alarming. On its face, the idea that any Democrat is meaningfully concerned with security was a joke. They consider it a bore. Implicit in their complaints was the Democrats' hope that something would happen so that they could attack Bush for not having prevented it. Liberals belittled every bust of a terrorist cell as an overhyped publicity stunt from that cornpone Ashcroft. According to Newsweek, Ashcroft was on a crusade. Liberals took the position that unless Ashcroft told them everything and destroyed the effectiveness of his investigations, they would refuse to believe him. No matter how spectacular the arrest, liberals invariably responded with, "You call that a terrorist?" When the government arrested suspected dirty bomber Jose Padilla, columnist Maureen Dowd said, "Is the Bush crowd hyping things?" The arrest of Padilla, Dowd said, was designed both to make our teeth chatter and our gratitude well up. Weren't we thankful that the Bushies were finally catching somebody and protecting us? Dowd was in stitches over the Bush administration's claiming the military has in custody a bona fide Al-Qaeda operative. The war on terrorism was a joke. Liberals' main point about the dirty bomber was that Padilla was too stupid to detonate a dirty bomb. In this one case, they had been given dispensation from the New York Times to attack the intelligence of a Latino. Padilla thus joined a short list of minorities liberals were allowed to vent their spleens on, the others being Justice Clarence Thomas and black voters in Florida. Citing anonymous experts, Dowd questioned whether Padilla had the brains or know-how to construct a nuclear bomb. Ashcroft, she said, had built up the dirty bomber into an Atta-like terrorist capable of leveling downtown Washington. But of course, as Dowd repeatedly intimated, Padilla was just a dumb Hispanic. This was as opposed to that Napoleonic genius, Muhammad Atta, master war strategist. The 9/11 terrorists didn't design the cruise missile's targeting system. They sucker-punched a sleeping giant. If shoe bomber Richard Reed hadn't been caught in the act of putting a match to a fuse on his Paris to Miami flight, liberals would have sniffed that he didn't have the brains to commit a terrorist act either. Only when a Muslim terrorist proved his bona fides by killing people would the media believe it. That would set off a code orange alert in the media, requiring total suppression of the information that the perp was a Muslim. Emerging as Al-Qaeda's leading spokesman in America, when Muslim terrorists first attacked the World Trade Center back in 1993, the New York Times ran the headline, "Jersey City Man is Charged in Bombing of Trade Center." On July 4, 2002, an Egyptian living in California named Hesham Mohammed Hidayat walked into an El Al terminal at the Los Angeles airport and started shooting Jews. Not that there's anything unpeaceful about that. In the past, Hidayat had complained about his neighbors flying a U.S. flag. He had a Read the Quran sticker on his front door, and he had expressed a virulent hatred for Jews. The Times reported that his motive for the shooting may have been some dispute over a fare. The Times also blacked out the information that the terrorists who seized a Moscow theater in October 2002 were Muslims. In a prolix front-page article about the hostage siege in Russia, the Times referred to the Islamic terrorists who stormed the theater exclusively as the captors, the separatists, and the guerrillas. The only hint that the captors were Muslims was the Times' derisive reference to Russian President Vladimir Putin's attempt to cast the rebels as international Islamic terrorists. The Times knows a cheap political ploy when it sees one. Most neurotically, the media aggressively censored the terrorists' Muslim names. When an Arab terrorist becomes an American citizen, that legal formality is strictly observed by the press. But when a Muslim terrorist legally changes his name to Muhammad, that legal formality is ignored. Dirty bomber Jose Padilla had his name legally changed to Ibrahim in the mid-90s. When he was arrested on terrorism-related charges in mid-2002, the media changed it back, allowing Maureen Dowd to argue that he was a dumb Hispanic incapable of assembling a dirty bomb. California trader John Walker Lind changed his name to Suleiman al-Lind in high school. When he was captured fighting with the Taliban, he was going by the name Abdul Hamid. He hadn't used the name Lind for years, but he was identified in the press exclusively as John Walker Lind. Stubbornly imitating an Alzheimer's jokes, when terrorist snipers in Maryland and Virginia turned out to be Muslims, the media treated it like a random crime. The older of the two Muslims had converted to Islam 17 years earlier, changed his name to John Muhammad, belonged to Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam, and cheered the 9/11 terrorist attack. Indeed, he was so gung-ho about the 9/11 attack that three of his acquaintances had contacted the FBI believing he could be a terrorist. Inadvertently including relevant facts in an article, the New York Times reported that Muhammad registered the getaway vehicle with the DMV on the first anniversary of the 9/11 attack, writing in the time of registration as 8:52 a.m., the precise moment the first plane hit the World Trade Center. But what the media saw as the crucial salient fact about sniper John Muhammad was that he was a Gulf War veteran. CNN valiantly insisted on calling John Muhammad by his Christian name, a name he hadn't used for 17 years. The New York Times described the snipers thus: John Allen Muhammad, 41, a Gulf War veteran, and John Lee Malvo, 17, a Jamaican. Inasmuch as the nation was at war with Islamic terrorists, you might think it would be of passing interest that the snipers were Muslims. But you needed a New York Times decoder ring to figure out that Gulf War veteran John Muhammad was a Muslim. The only clue as to the snipers' religion was the Times' repeated insistence that Islam had absolutely nothing to do with the shootings. The refusal to make a connection between Muslim extremists and unending violence by Muslim extremists borders on psychopathological disturbance. Islamic fanatics were staging random acts of brutality against Americans. When the Maryland snipers turned out to be Muslims who hated America and admired the 9/11 terrorists, someone in the media might have remembered that. Instead, all news outlets aggressively hid the fact that the snipers were Muslims. Liberals bar the most benign expressions of religion by Little America. Only a religion that is highly correlated with fascistic attacks on the U.S. commands their respect and protection. Liberals become indignant when you question their patriotism, but simultaneously laugh at dumb Americans who love their country and hate the enemy. They think real patriotism should consist of redoubled efforts to expand welfare payments. The New York Times ran a Tom Tomorrow cartoon sneering about Americans who believe, with unwavering faith, in an invisible, omniscient deity who favors those born in the middle of the North American landmass. This is how liberals conceive of America: an undifferentiated landmass in the middle of North America. The point was simply to convey all the proper prejudices of elitist liberals against ordinary Americans. While hooting with laughter at patriotic Americans, liberals prattle on and on about the right to dissent as the true mark of patriotism, and claim their unrelenting kvetching is a needed corrective to jingoism. It's not jingoism, and the only people who use that word are fifth columnists. Through their enervating dialogues and endless concern with process, liberals have made themselves incapable of feeling hate for the enemy. The president of the ACLU said America's response to terrorism was exactly the same phenomenon as McCarthyism. And so it was. Once again, liberals would defend people contriving plots to murder Americans. Liberals simply did not have an implacable desire to kill those who cheered the wanton slaughter of thousands of Americans. But that's the way the American people felt. Anyone who could rise above that, anyone who had moved on from that, wasn't angry in the first place. Liberals are appalled by patriotism with an edge of anger because it might lead America to defend itself. This is Ann Coulter. I hope you have enjoyed this production of Treason: Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Sherry Huber, abridgment by Virginia Noonan. Text copyright 2003 by Ann Coulter. Production copyright 2003 Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.